Full Service Radio is proudly supported and hosted by Simplecast, the easiest way for a podcast creator to publish and distribute audio on the internet. For more information, visit simplecast.com.
Full Service Radio.
Welcome to the Sun Cinema Podcast, a weekly radio show that examines the highs and lows of the medium of film through the filtered lens of Washington, D.C.'s only privately owned art house cinema. I'm your host, Jason Cauley, and I'm joined by my co-host and the proprietors of Sun Cinema, David Cabrera and Ryan Hunter Mitchell. Gentlemen.
Heyo.
Hey, Dave.
It's cold out there. We're playing Politicians in My Eyes by Death.
Bad Brains?
Oh, come on. We're showing this movie tonight.
Yeah, right? Band called Death.
Yeah, it's a documentary about a cool punk band
that was punk before most.
Before us, for sure.
What's more punk than Death?
That's true.
That's actually true.
Someone came in the other day and was trying to get tickets, and they were like, yeah, I've just like really been trying to sell people on Death. And I was like, you should just say that with no context all the time.
Whatever, that always applies. It's February. It's goddamn beautiful outside.
It feels like May.
We were going to go outside and call you, Jack.
Just do the show outside and have you sit in here, order some food and talk about the food that we ordered.
Order food to the studio for me, too.
Yeah. Whoa. We hadn't gotten that far. Okay. But also, we would never do that to you.
All right, David, tell us about the programming this month real quick. Let's get this out of the way. It's a new month. It's February.
This month is predominantly black cinema, focused on the black experience, etc. And as usual, we, you know, tried to break it down into different days of the week with different themes. We have a strange calendar. Oh, this is Sun Cinema. We have a small art house movie theater in Mount Pleasant in Washington, D.C. Hopefully you already know that. But if not... So we try to break... You know, we try to focus our months on a certain theme and...
Sundays? Let's see.
Sundays are all art house movies. A movie called Come Back Africa we showed on Sunday. It was very good. It had Miriam Makeba in it. She's the one that does Pata Pata, that song. Nope. It's cool. Black Girl, it's a early African Senegalese film. Bless Their Little Hearts is Charles Burnett and Bill... Bill. UCLA.
Yeah,
LA. The LA Rebellion thing. And Sankofa is Haile Gerima. I always want to say Haile Magira. Both from DC. He is a filmmaker from Ethiopia. He started Sankofa Bookstore and was a professor at Howard. The name of the movie is Sankofa. That is. Probably not fun. It's about slavery, and the idea is that it was one of the first films that focuses more on the rebellion side of that, and sort of giving narrative and face to that.
Well, and it's kind of like a magical realism, right?
Yeah.
Or surrealism, yeah. Almost. I saw some clips of it. I saw some read up on it a bit. Seems really cool.
Yeah. So Tuesday nights, we're doing a bunch of docs. Tonight, a band called Death. They're all music docs. Next week, Grace Jones, Bloodlight and Bammy. The 19th, Thelonious Monk, Straight No Chaser. And the 26th, Black Wax, which is a doc about Gil Scott-Heron.
Coming to D.C.
To D.C., doing some performances here and so forth. That should be pretty cool. This is actually a very focused month now that I'm looking at the... Like you can just go down each...
It's organized. There's not a lot of...
Good job, us.
The algorithm writes itself now.
Yeah. Wednesday nights, our dear friend Pharaoh Hawk, Tarek Hawk, is presenting a bunch of movies and or shorts.
Or cartoons.
Or cartoons, yeah. Tomorrow night is a focus on George Harriman, the animations of George Harriman. He was a black animator. It's called Crazy Cat, or Crazy Cats. The 13th, Putney Swope. It's a Robert Downey Sr. Yeah. Movie about a black executive in a PR firm. And
seems wild.
Yeah. I feel ashamed that I haven't actually seen this movie all the way through. I've seen it while he's bartending at Showtime, and I've seen it. I started watching it a few different times, and it's amazing what I've seen so far.
You know, I ran into Larry last night, friend of the podcast, Larry, neighborhood curmudgeon who bothers us at Sons all the time, Larry. And I gave him a calendar. He's like, well, is there anything I'm going to want to see? Or is it all Kevin Bacon movies this month?
Is it all Kevin Bacon?
Smart ass. I gave him the calendar. And
I wish we had the tenacity to troll so hard and just do a Kevin Bacon month next month. And he wouldn't even see it.
Yeah. No, he asked what he would like, and I recommend it. I was like, oh, you might like Putney Swope. He's like, oh, does that have... wait, what actor? He asked... Oh, does it have Kevin Spacey? I'm like, God, what? No. He's like, you should do Kevin Spacey movies. I'm like, no.
Whoa. Okay.
He's either being a troll or he literally has no idea the cultural zeitgeist of right now.
Yikes.
My guess is the latter.
Yeah, yeah. It's probably that.
So then the following Thursday, The Black Klansman from 1966, which I didn't know existed. It's another movie that Tarek is presenting.
A revenge flick.
It's a revenge flick, yeah. A black guy infiltrating the KKK, but I think it has something to do with someone harming his lady. The 27th, Cleopatra Jones, blaxploitation classic. Thursdays are sort of a modge podge. We're doing some cocktail nights, Lazy Omakase. We're doing Guess Who's Coming to Dinner, which I think we're going to get into a little bit later.
Oh, for sure.
Some Sidney Poitier. Ganja and Hess. Experimental film from Bill Gunn, somewhat about vampires.
Yeah.
Somewhat about, I'm not sure.
Life, eternity.
There you go.
No, yeah. It's, you know, we've thrown it on before because it used to be on YouTube, so we could just throw it on. It's pretty wild, and I know a lot of like horror fans are obsessed with this movie.
When did this come out?
70-something.
70-something.
Yeah.
Spike Lee remade it.
Right.
The Sweet Blood of Jesus.
Yeah,
it has
exactly.
Like a very low rating on IMDb. I watched the trailer for it and I was like,
yeah, people didn't love it.
Well, but it's the kind of thing where it's like, all right, that's cool you did that because now that probably, because that came out a few years ago and then they just like restored Ganja and Hess. So you got to wonder if, like, you know, as big of a flop that was, maybe that's why people are like, oh, let's
watch the good one.
Let's watch the original. Fridays are all like 2018 bangers. 2018 was
it was a great year for movies.
Yeah, it was a great. So we started with Black Panther, Sorry to Bother You, which we're going to get into later as well, Blind Spotting, and the new Spike Lee movie, Black Klansman. Saturdays were kind of like comedies and all over the place. We did Groundhog Day on Groundhog Day. The Last Dragon is this Saturday. Barry Gordon's The
so
Last
much
Dragon.
Fun.
Yeah, it's a fun one.
It's a disaster of a movie, but it's so much fun.
Oh, such a! I love The Last Dragon.
Yeah, followed by CB4, which is also a hilarious movie. Yeah. That'll be fun. It's going to depend on like the crowd and like.
Yeah.
Right.
Oh, I hope it's. Yeah, the trailer is amazing.
We're doing a lot of Chris Elliott Saturdays because he's in Groundhog Day.
That's true. That's right. Oh, my God.
And then Sneaks, which is a local band. Local artist is doing a thing. A music video premiere.
A thing.
And then Mondays we're doing sort of a separate series on sort of trans lives. Josh Vogelsong's Screen Queen is presenting a bunch of movies. Some are comedy, some are a little bit more hard-hitting. So Boys Don't Cry on the 4th.
Pretty hard-hitting.
We showed that last night. Princessa which I haven't seen, but the trailer looked cool.
Yeah, I hear good things about it.
Yeah. All About My Mother. It's an Almodovar movie that most people probably know. And then The Crying Game, which was...
also good.
Neil Jordan.
Yeah.
And I believe there might be a... I got a text about a drag show for that one, maybe.
For The Crying Game?
For The Crying Game.
That could be fun.
Oh, yeah. That's cool.
So.
All right. Well,
that's the month.
Yeah, that's the month. And then, yeah. Let's... since we're doing it this week, and since it's since we haven't been able to gush about it enough, let's talk Sorry to Bother You. You guys fans? Nah.
Absolutely fans.
I loved it.
Yeah, was it worth watching? I watched the trailer, I debated watching it, and I just felt like this is I don't know.
But you haven't watched it?
I've not seen it, no.
Sorry to Bother
What?
You?
What? No, I haven't seen it.
Yeah, you should see it.
Sorry to Bother You, man. But you should.
Yeah.
We'll not ruin I think we can have a conversation without ruining.
Yeah, no, I think so.
A great aspect.
Good.
Of
I'll
it.
Play the part of a listener who hasn't seen this film.
Yeah, no, it's you know, just doing some, you know, background on the storyline and how this film got made. I mean, it's not an uncommon story, I'm sure. You know, this really was like a 10 years in the making kind of film coming together. Ultimately, like, got its feet under it through Sundance and through the Sundance. What am I wanting to say? The Sundance.
Oh, yeah. It's like the Sundance
workshops.
Institute has a writer's workshop.
They have a writer's workshop and they have a director's workshop. And Boots Riley went through both of those prior to making this film. And part of the Sundance director's workshop is you end up with a night where you get like 60 truly, I'm not exaggerating, like multi millionaires in a room who you just basically go in and pitch to. And he got his initial, you know, out of the gate funding from that night. And, you know,
well,
and I'm like jumping 20 steps ahead of where he had like an initial idea. It took him a year to write the thing.
Yeah.
And, you know, Ryan and I were talking before the show about like just all of these stories where, you know, like he runs into David Eggers on the street in San Francisco and is like, hey, can you, you know, you got any advice for me? And Eggers is like, you know what? I'll just publish the whole thing for you.
Yeah. I think, and like,
and we'll put it out.
So
that sounds like real life.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, like, it's just crazy, how these things end up coming to fruition. And this was still like 4 or 5 years before the movie gets made, you know, like it wasn't like, oh, I ran into David Eggers. He published my script, sent it out to 20,000 registered followers. And, you know, everybody came knocking. It was like that happened. Then he introduced him to Spike Jonze. They had a conversation, didn't go anywhere. Then he had a conversation with this person, somebody like, I think it was either David Cross or Patton Oswalt, who like he initially sent it to. And they were like, yeah, I really had no desire to read this thing. I wasn't going to read it at all.
In the most Hollywood circumstance, they both said, yeah.
Yeah, like, no, so absolutely.
They were the first, like, people.
They were the first people on board. The two white guys in the movie were the first two guys to sign up and be like, hey, there's something to this. You know, we want to be involved.
So basic premise, Jack, you might be aware, is it's Lakeith Stanfield plays a guy who gets an interview to work at a phone bank, basically. He's I forget what he's even selling at first, though, but who cares? He's a telemarketer. It's kind of inconsequential what he's selling in the beginning. And
good question. I don't remember either.
Yeah, and then it kind of becomes a movie about code switching because he's terrible at it. And then Danny Glover tells him, well, try your white voice. And then this becomes a whole thing of like, okay, he's really good at this white voice. I think David Cross does his white voice.
Yeah.
He does an impeccable white voice. David Cross is incredible at it.
The best in the biz.
Yeah. He's a very white voice.
But then it becomes a kind of complex, surrealist movie.
Totally magical realism. I mean, he self-describes it as, and I'm going to get this a little wrong, he did have his pitch down. Like, I've watched 4 or 5 interviews and he pitches it the same way every single time. Like, he had his elevator pitch down, and it was basically like, you know, this is an absurdist comedy, absurdist black comedy that morphs into magical realism, that morphs into something else, like surrealism or something, yeah. You know, and you know, it's all filtered through the lens of telemarketing. And
yeah.
Everybody's like, okay, I got to know more about this.
So he tries pretty ambitiously to make the world of telemarketing go into union organizing, because Boots Riley himself is an organizer. He kind of describes that as one of his many jobs over time. He's like, does music in the coup, but mostly he's been an organizer around generally socialist lefty issues in Oakland. And then he wanted to become a filmmaker because he thought this was a way to get this message across. So,
well, he initially, just the background there too, you know, he was in film school when the coup kind of took off a little, mm-hmm. enough to where he dropped out of film school and kind of devoted his time solely to the music for a number of years. And according to, you know, him and in several interviews, you know, he never lost this itch to like want to make a movie, and sat down and had this idea that originally was initiated by a line that he had written down for a song. And took that little single line from, you know, a scratch line from his journal, and was like, yeah, maybe I can explore this idea a little bit more. Because it was something, you know, yada, 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 the white man's voice.
Mm-hmm.
And then he's like, oh, there's something to this. Maybe I can play with this in a film idea. Sat down a year later, he ends up, you know, finishing a script called Sorry to Bother You.
In that interview he does with Questlove.
At
the Lincoln Center, when I think it was like one of the premieres or a little bit after the premiere.
It's before the premiere. It's okay. Like they're doing like a little sneak preview kind of thing.
All right. He talks about there that, you know, the trailer and the idea of the white voice kind of cuts through the nuance. It's like a real quick sell of the movie.
Right.
And that's pretty funny, but it actually moves beyond that real quick. And that's like a funny aspect of it. But it gets really nuanced throughout the movie of like how everyone has to present themselves in a certain way to be taken seriously or to achieve a certain objective.
See, that's awesome to hear. I wish trailers came with, like, you know how they have the rating disclaimer at the beginning? It should also be like, the following film is more nuanced than this trailer makes it seem.
Right.
This trailer is made for the purpose of selling movie tickets.
Yeah, right. It moves past that cheap joke pretty quick. And the whole movie...
I think the genius of Boots Riley in this script, if there's genius to be added to it, is that he was able to kind of loop you into this bigger story through the hook of this kind of comical idea of turning on a black telemarketer turning on his white voice. Like in the previews, everything leading up to it, that's kind of all you know, like before the movie came out, like, oh, it's going to be some kind of little bit of social commentary about like what it is to be, you know, black in today's society, mm-hmm. and using your white voice and all this. But it really like takes a hard, deep dive on a number of different topics, not the least of which is like slavery and other ideas.
And almost to a fault, it does become a little unfocused, but it takes this kind of... So you get the preview, you get the idea. He's a white voice, he turns it on well, he starts being really good at telemarketing, moves up in the company. So a good portion through the movie, you're like, okay, this is just what the trailer was. It's nuanced, it's fun, but where's it going to go? Because the story kind of writes itself. Like, he's either going to have a fall, or he's going to see how corrupt this is and leave it or something. But it just goes in completely different directions than you see after a while. It like builds you up for like, okay, you kind of know what's going to happen. Like, A, B, or C are going to happen to this main character through his rise.
Right.
But then it goes with...
It takes about,
different than you think.
It takes a couple of hard turns, you know, about halfway through, you start getting a little kind of a glimpse behind as he's moving up the ladder and officially is kind of at the top of his game. That's where everything starts taking like a hard right for 15 minutes and then a hard left, and you get more information. And you're like, oh my gosh, where are we going on this?
Yeah.
On this ride.
That's probably where that's the make or break for a lot of people.
I think so too. Yeah.
About and halfway through. And it's like, you're there. Like, I leaned into it and I was like, oh, I'm ready for this. This is great. This is super weird. I was excited that it was weird and took such a twist. And
well, and then it's able to go a little further. What ultimately is trying to like portray this philosophy of, you know, pretty, some lefty philosophy, but it has its limits because we all know we've all worked a grind, or hopefully most people have like worked in a grind. We see how bullshit jobs are. We see how bullshit a ladder is. But then he's able to like pontificate way further by taking some really outrageous turns. Things with like, for instance, Tessa Thompson's character with the art gallery.
Right.
He starts critiquing art in a certain way. He starts critiquing a lot of things about
how, and the difference is there, and kind of he starts asking the question through that lens is, you know, a sellout in the business world, is it any different in the art world? Like, you know, you're saying you're an artist so that you're not part of this kind of established capitalist society. But when you find success in that art, does that immediately corrupt your ability to, you know, kind of create art from an original place?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
It's a great exploration of that kind of ideology.
Well, and the limits of personal, not just personal gain, but individualism. You know, everyone ultimately is kind of looking at out for themselves. Like, there's an exchange with his uncle.
Right.
He's like, oh, you're just a man taking our money. He's like, dude, I'm your uncle. Right. You know, like, so everyone is
trying to keep my family down. He's like,
I'm trying to pay a mortgage.
We are family. Yeah. So it does look at like how people use personal identity is a big one, and personal decisions to, and the necessity of their environment to justify their personal decisions. But he looks about, I think he does a good job through this wacky movie of showing like, yeah, it can't be left up to personal design how we do things. There are certain structures in place that we have to navigate, and that controls our decisions more than what we can personally decide. Armie Hammer in this is probably, I think, his best role, really.
Armie Hammer is one of the coolest dudes out there, in my opinion. Like, he will not be restricted into, like, he's one of the most handsome human beings on the planet, and he will not, like, take that bait that Hollywood would love for him to be, like, the romantic lead in everything, the, you know, the kind of superhuman white, you know, ideology of like great white heroism.
Yeah.
You know, and he just won't do that. I love him for it.
Yeah. It's
outside of Lone Ranger.
Yeah.
I think that was his lesson learned.
But
I do. I think, I mean, I haven't read anything about it. I don't know this guy at all, but I feel like after that, he kind of turned it on its ear and started doing some much more interesting stuff.
He's more interesting than Lone Ranger.
Yeah. I mean,
Armie Hammer is, for our listeners, is the person that's the older gentleman in Call Me By Your Name.
Yeah.
That's probably
tremendous performance in that as well.
Most well known for that, probably.
Yeah.
Or most well known as the American in Man from U.N.C.L.E. Or no, he's the Russian in Man from U.N.C.L.E.
The Russian.
He is in The Man from U.N.C.L.E. That's true.
No, he plays. You get to explore in this movie, like, what if Elon Musk, who we all like.
Oh, he was one of the Winklevosses.
Yeah, what if the Winklevosses became Elon Musk and then got to dramatically reorganize society? Like, he really disrupts society and implements like some nouveau feudalism in the movie. And that becomes a whole angle of like how to look at how we might accidentally be reasserting ourselves into roles of feudalism.
Yeah.
It's such a broad movie, so it does become a little unfocused. But if you're able to touch on all of these through a telemarketer,
right,
it's pretty impressive.
I think the idea that, you know, he was just able to make something that kind of wasn't just a super small little independent film that only played in little art houses. Like, this got, you know, some momentum behind it, should have had some momentum behind it, you know, and actually got wide releases and, you know, people actually went out and saw this. This film made a lot of money, put Boots Riley into an odd position where he's not, unlike his, you know, Lakeith Stanfield character, where suddenly now he's in Hollywood being like the most, you know, lauded guy out there, despite getting zero Oscar nominations for this film, which is
nonsense.
A hilarious joke.
Yeah. Well, we had a conversation at Suns the other night with some people that were hanging out about this person thought that the movie was, it had too many messages and it was a little sloppy. You know, my argument was like, well, I'm just excited to see a movie that is this weird with this kind of message even being in mainstream theaters, like you were saying, like,
right.
Not just being some sort of niche, you know, thing. And there, and I, you know, then I started thinking about it from their perspective of like, well, you know, I was ready for this message and this kind of movie. Like, you know, we show a lot of unique, weird stuff that's not mainstream. But I, you know, I'm prepped for that. And I was, you know, I was like, okay, well, maybe you're right. Like, maybe all this is lost on people who are just trying to be entertained. But also like, it's so, in, you know, we're being subtle about describing some of the details of what makes this movie so great. Yeah, I do agree. I think it's pretty hard to miss. I mean,
it's not on the nose.
It's not subtle in
right.
What it's trying to get
worldview
get across. But also, a part of that conversation we were talking about, They Live, and you know, They Live is, you know, considered this very subversive movie, but also this B movie that's goofy that has, you know, Roddy Piper as mm-hmm. the main character, you know, a professional wrestler as the main character. But it is a prolific movie about consumerism mm-hmm. and capitalism. And and my point was, or my question was, like, are these, you know, I think we've either talked about this or this is a conversation that comes up often. Like, is a movie like They Live or Sorry to Bother You, like, do those movies have to be somewhat strange or somewhat goofy or whatever in mm-hmm. order to even get the green light to be made? You know, like, They Live, if
like
they,
they're entering through the side door, they can't, yeah, that movie can't come in
yeah,
through the front
that's
door.
What I was trying to get at. Yeah, yeah, like, yeah. They Live is, you know, like, at heart, I think has a very strong message, but like, if it was this really serious movie, you know, put out like, who's the director?
Carpenter.
Yeah, Carpenter. Carpenter. Yeah, yeah,
yeah,
yeah. Like, I don't know, I think everyone would have been like, you know. So I wonder the same thing with Sorry to Bother You, where it's like, yeah, you have to, like, do something a little bit
I think there's something to be said for a heavy, heavy topic or multiple heavy topics. Mm-hmm. You know, when you're talking about capitalism, the idea
I wonder if specifically that topic, though, in sort of a very capitalistic enterprise, you know, movie making is very
this is dead in the water.
Yeah, yeah. So I wonder if that specifically requires a different.
Yeah, I think so. I think it does, because at the end of the day, you're dealing with a medium that is visual first and foremost, and has to bring some sort of ability to not just deliver a message, but tell a story in doing so. And something as heavy and as, you know, you can say it however you want, but as complicated as capitalism, the idea, very idea of capitalism can be, the very idea of democracy, the very mm-hmm. idea of feudalism, slavery, all these huge, heavy topics have got to be filtered through some lens that is palatable to an audience.
Uh-huh. Otherwise, and to a certain degree, I think, like, most of us want that also.
To
be fair.
I don't want to just be preached at for two and a half hours or 3 hours. I want, like,
absolutely not.
Unless it's a documentary.
I want to have this conversation.
Know.
You know.
Yeah.
I want a great film to provoke conversation and do all of those things while doing the very simple thing of entertaining and engaging the audience at the same time.
Yeah.
Well, and you bring up They Live and entering through the side door. You know, and Trevor Noah interviews him, and he says, you know, not since The Matrix have I come out of the movie theater and not been sure of the world I'm living in.
Right,
and I'm like, I wasn't a huge fan of The Matrix, and I think I would have thought kind of the same way about They Live at first. It's like, sure, we get it. Consumerism is bad, or the realities we build around ourselves. Like, it seemed like, you think this is so profound. Of course, like, of course we have these ideas. And now, a few decades later after seeing this, and I love They Live, and The Matrix, I'd probably like to re-examine. And now watching this, I'm like, it really is only so often that a movie, especially a mainstream movie, gets to shake these things. Like, you might think it's, like, overdone, but it really isn't. It's rare that a movie gets to come out and portray, like, a pretty nuanced philosophy that we can all talk about. I mean, we can use Sorry to Bother You, The Matrix, They Live for 50 years after they're made. We can use them the same way we can use Socrates or something to examine what's going on around us. And these are way more entertaining ways.
Right.
Like, now I'm like, oh, The Matrix got to talk about things like this while being a pretty cool martial arts film with cool graphics, et cetera, et cetera. Yeah. Like, for all it's worth
some groundbreaking kind of action-y sci-fi type stuff.
Yeah. And coming in through the side door, like you're saying, like, it lets you cut through the nuance and the boringness of examining this in such a dry way. You get to have like a fun, enthralling way, really out there way you hadn't thought of to examine these ideas.
Yeah.
So y'all mentioned Oh Lucky Man. So in one of the interviews...
Yeah, he says that that was a bigger influence for him than like Menace to Society.
So I wanted to read two separate synopses for y'all and for those who are listening. I've seen Oh Lucky Man, but it's been a really long time. It's something that I, like when I was deep in a rabbit hole of movies that I watched. It stars Malcolm McDowell. But these two synopses will give you an idea of like, oh shit, yeah, duh. A tenacious young British man, Mick Travis, Malcolm McDowell, is determined to be successful. Starting off as a coffee salesman, Mick is soon promoted within his company. Mm. Then things take a series of bizarre turns, and Mick is abducted by a military agency. Later, he becomes smitten with the gorgeous Patricia, Helen Mirren, and winds up working for her father, sinister executive Sir James Burgess, Ralph Richardson. As Mick's tale continues, his experiences get progressively stranger. So that one gives you one sort of idea. Then this one, this is the IMDb synopsis. This sprawling surrealist musical serves as an allegory for the pitfalls of capitalism as it follows the adventures of a young coffee salesman in Europe. Many actors and actresses play multiple roles, giving the movie a stagey tone. Well, that part, not so much. But
no, but yeah. I mean...
yeah, it's only 3 hours long, so if you have a minute, check it out.
Only 3 hours? Yeah. Oh, good.
But it's another one where I remember like watching the first half of it, and you're like, this one, I think, sorry to bother you, is more entertaining to me, and maybe it's because it's more
shorter
now and relevant and shorter. But yeah, I remember watching this movie and like kind of like getting through the first half and be like, all right, and then all of a sudden like, wait, what? Like, what am I watching now?
Yeah.
So it certainly has that. So that's cool that he mentioned that, and That's cool that I didn't even think about it.
Yeah, if you miss like 5 minutes of sorry to bother. If you miss the wrong 5 minutes, well, Jack, man, you'll have no idea what the hell movie you're watching. You're like, did the movie end and Netflix just picked the next one for me?
Yeah.
Oh, I'm sold.
Let's take a break from Sorry to Bother You and let's play a clip of from Guess Who's Coming to Dinner, a movie we'll be showing this week as well. Now let's talk The Goat. Sidney Poitier.
Yeah. You and your whole lousy generation believes the way it was for you is the way it's got to be. And not until your whole generation has lain down and died will the dead weight of you be off our backs. You understand? You've got to get off my back.
Maybe... I'm trying to... I struggle to think of anyone... in the history of cinema who came about at, you could say the exact right time or the unlucky timing of Sidney Poitier coming into the world of acting and the world of cinema and Hollywood and the late 50s, early 60s and the time of civil rights in America, and could not imagine a single... I mean, you have to like think about the fact that this guy was the sole African-American leading man in all of Hollywood. You know, that was it. That's the list for a decade almost. Yeah. He was the list.
That's a burden.
If you had... Yeah, I mean, a truly like real burden. That, you know, this guy... came from the Bahamas, you know, worked as a dishwasher, didn't know how to read when he got to this country, worked as a dishwasher, learned how to read, learned how to talk like an American, and became interested in theater and thought that would be a good way for him to help continue to improve his diction. And started in theater in New York and ultimately led to, you know, the career in Hollywood.
Career.
Yeah, an okay, you know, kind of legendary career in Hollywood. But I mean, truly, truly one of those guys that, like, until recently, I've been reading a great book called Pictures at the Revolution by a guy named Mark Harris. The book came out about 10 years ago, but it reads like it was written today, especially given what's going on. But it specifically follows the five films that were nominated for Best Picture in 1967, of which two of which Sidney Poitier was in, Guess Who's Coming to Dinner, and In the Heat of the Night. The other three films are The Graduate, Bonnie and Clyde, and Dr. Doolittle. The five nominees for Best Picture in 67. And it just examines, like, basically the 5 years preceding that, when these movies were just kind of in the gestation period, and how much film got changed by things like the French New Wave, and then how much society was changing through civil rights, and how much Hollywood was resisting to adapt to that world, the old Hollywood of, you know, a bunch of old white guys, which it kind of still is.
Oddly enough.
Weird how that works.
It really is, like, insane, just going back and reading some of this. I'm happy to, like, quote from this book, because I find it completely enthralling and captivating. But a big part of this book talks about how Sidney Poitier, like, came to be, and what that meant at that time when he was coming to be in the late 50s and early 60s in Hollywood, and in America, for that matter, given where we were in terms of civil rights.
Yeah, and for context, like, what are some of the, let's think, what are his breakout, what are the big movies leading up to Guess Who's Coming to Dinner, Heat of the Night?
Like, yeah, no, I...
Leading up to that.
Right, I think the first really, like, truly big thing in it was another Stanley Kramer movie who directed Guess Who's Coming to Dinner, called The Defiant Ones, with he and Tony Curtis play, it sounds like nothing now. So, I mean, you have to put it in the context of 1959 America. They play two members of a chain gang who are chained together who escape. And the idea that you're even going to have a movie where a white man and a black man constantly have to touch each other because, you know, they're chained together is insane.
I'm sure that was challenging.
That was in 58 too, which...
Yeah. Theaters all over the South were not showing this movie. You know, just out and out would not show the film. And so a lot of Sidney Poitier's films, like The Defiant Ones, had to be made with a budget where they knew they could make their money back on the West Coast and East Coast, and not have to deal with the South as part of the budget planning recouping the budget. And so it made for these kind of very small films, not the least would like Raisin in the Sun. They're more of kind of, soundstage dramas, you know, sure. Very, very small films that can be very easily controlled, all done on the studio lot.
But the reception's pretty big for these, right?
Hugely big. I mean,
despite them being small films.
Right. The country can't help but fall in love with this, you know, young actor. And it just leads to kind of...
Lily's in the Field.
Lily's in the Field, which he won the Oscar for. First time a lead actor Oscar ever went to anyone other than a white man. That was 1963. I think the film in 64 was the Oscars. Yeah. But I mean, there were even like Anne Bancroft delivers his Oscar to him, and she gives him a kiss and a hug, like embraces him when he comes up, like everybody does at every award show when they hand over the statue at her. It was blown so far out of proportion, you know, across the country. How dare she touch that black man, let alone give him a kiss and a hug,
Or the flip side of this, like, ooh, look how progressive we are.
Right. And that was a little bit of Hollywood wanted that belief. That was, can I just read this little clip?
Yeah.
Little piece from Pictures at the Revolution by Mark Harris. In the 1960s, the producers of the Academy Awards began what eventually became the tradition of inviting the previous year's Best Actor and Actress recipients back to the show as presenters the following April. So in the spring of 1965, 1 year after taking home his Oscar for Lilies in the Field, Sidney Poitier found himself at the Santa Monica Civic Auditorium again, this time handing the statuette to Julie Andrews for Mary Poppins and watching the prize he had won last year go to Rex Harrison. If some in the film industry had indulged themselves in the belief that Poitier's Academy Award would create new opportunities for black actors in Hollywood, or even for him, Poitier had not let himself be tempted by false optimism. For all of Bob Hope's tinny jokes about the evenings, about how the evening looked like the Oscars looked more like the United Nations than the Oscars, Poitier's career that year, since the success of Lilies in the Field, had not changed markedly. He had not worked for 6 months. I mean, the guy just won the Oscar. He is on his way to becoming the number. He's already one of the top five draws in all of movies. He's about to become number one.
Oh, by 67, definitely.
By 67, he is the number one draw at the movies. I mean, he is like unapproachable and couldn't get work, you know, because there weren't roles for black men.
Yeah.
You know, just wasn't going to happen.
That's such a bummer. But of course, I'm not surprised.
Yeah.
I mean, nor is anyone. But
yeah, I mean, just the difference in the country from 1963-64 to 1966-67 was so vast. Like the how things shifted, how our perspectives shifted, what we were as a country ready to accept and kind of ready to acknowledge as a country that we had kind of ignored and kind of buried our heads in the ground is just dynamics. So that by 67, when he does Guess Who's Coming to Dinner and In the Heat of the Night, he's the number one movie star in the country and still kind of carrying the mantle of, you know, the ideal African-American male, you know.
And he's, I think he, at this point, from what I'm guessing is, it sounds like he's helping Hollywood a lot more than Hollywood's helping him here,
for sure. And showing an immense amount of restraint as a human being.
Oh, for you
know,
sure.
Every interview, you know, he can't in any way, early on at least, he could not buck the system. He couldn't be anything but lauding of Hollywood and the opportunities. And, you know, he would make some very minor comment about, you know, wishing there were more black female roles. And that would get picked up by everyone as he doesn't.
A hot take.
Yeah, like he doesn't appreciate his position in Hollywood and what we've given him. And that's both inside and outside that industry, you know.
I believe
he
so
couldn't
easily.
Make a move that wasn't magnified tenfold, you know. So, I mean, he literally had to watch every step he made. And it's like, everybody has to do that. I get it. But I don't think it's truly quite often appreciated how much he had to do that and in the manner that he had to do that during the time in which he was doing it. It is not like anybody else in the history of cinema.
That's so many things cross-secting right there.
Oh, so much. So much. Not the least of which are, you know, Hollywood's inability to kind of understand the changing dynamic in cinema itself. You know, the French New Wave had kind of showed, hey, there's this whole new way of telling stories. And inside Hollywood, there were people, oddly enough, like Warren Beatty, who like got that and was like, yes, we need to make more movies like this, and we need to kind of open things up in the way we tell stories. I mean, the old Hollywood system that just would not accept that change, that we're still making these overly bloated, you know, musicals like Dr. Doolittle. And kind of
super orchestrated,
super marketed, you know, professionally marketed so that they got the appropriate praise that they wanted. And you're dealing with critics who, you know, for all intents and purposes at that time were in their 60s and 70s, all white males by and large. There's Pauline Kael out there, but I mean, there aren't a lot of women even, and the rest are all white men. Who some happen to be complete bigots and some happen to be, you know, want to be liberals as much as can be, you know, but even they know, hey, I've got a readership. I can't come out right and say this in 1962 or 63. So by 67, the dynamic shift that had happened in the country had finally kind of taken root in Hollywood as well, and allowed Poitier to take on some meteor roles, I guess.
Such as Coming to Dinner.
Well, and then The Heat of the Night, primarily, I would say even more than...
Yeah, but we're not showing that.
We already showed that one.
Well, there's like the big debate between those two movies that, you know, even in Guess Who's Coming to Dinner, he still has to be, you know, we were talking about it earlier, he has to be the doctor. And he's not just a doctor. Yeah, he's so like the doctor.
Guess Who's Coming to Dinner is a, it's a white woman bringing Sidney Poitier back to her parents. They're engaged.
White liberal parents from San Francisco. Yeah. I mean, like important this. And, yeah. Like yeah, they're
liberal. Yeah.
Self, I guess, self-gradulating, you know, congratulating white liberals.
They're
know?
Hollywood. They're Hollywood in 64 for giving the Oscar too.
Right. And I mean, they're, it's great in the sense that like this is the intents or the purpose of the film, I guess, is like the challenge that that puts on these, you know, self-congratulating liberals. Are you really liberal because here's a black man that wants to marry your daughter?
Yeah.
You know,
which
in 1967,
I see a bit of the challenge, but then, yeah, then they raise the bar so high for him that he's this impeccable human. One, he's insanely attractive.
Oh my God. Yeah. He's
super accomplished.
Yeah. And can't be anything but that, you know, mm-hmm. can't be anything but a, like, above reproach, you know, as a human being. They're a flawless, you know, resume of a human being. And so just kind of looking at that, even as late as 67, and Stanley Kramer, who did The Defiant once and had a weird history with Hollywood and kind of wanted to be known as this very progressive and really was mm-hmm. like truly a hard left-leaning liberal
okay.
supported, you know, civil rights movement and wanted to like take part in it by making films like The Defiant Ones and Guess Who's Coming to Dinner. Still, when they were making that in 66 and into 67, you know, he didn't realize how much things were changing on at that time, like in that mm-hmm. zeitgeist of 67. And what ends up happening is you get Guess Who's Coming to Dinner, which on the surface sounds like a great kind of groundbreaking type of film, mm-hmm. but ends up being a very soft looking parlor movie next Definitely. To something like In the Heat of the Night that came out the same year.
Absolutely. And you can tell it's written by
yeah, 60-year-old
old white man. White man. Yeah. Yeah. Even the small spoiler, when he is talking to his dad at the end of that scene, he, you know, yeah. I remember he tells him something like, well, you think of yourself as a colored man and I think of myself as a man,
right?
And it's like, yeah, of course you think that's that easy in 67 to just like right. think.
Well, I mean, just to put things into perspective, I mean, yeah, yeah, to put that into perspective though, I mean, just the very Definitely. Idea of two black men on screen having a genuine, you know, kind of socialistic or societal conversation hadn't been on screen before.
Probably not in a big picture.
It had never been done in a big picture. Yeah. I mean, it had been done on smaller independent films and sure. things like that. And we could yeah. talk about Cassavetes' Shadows and
sure.
already dealing with interracial stuff in 1959. But nobody saw those movies,
uh-huh.
you know, yeah. For years and years, no one saw those films. This was opening across the country. So yeah, I mean, it's just, it's almost impossible to articulate what Sidney Poitier went through. And on top of that, like, happened to be a great fucking actor. You know? Like,
yeah.
He wasn't just the face of, you know, African-American, you know, hopes and dreams in Hollywood. I mean, he also happened to be amazing at what he did. Yeah. And went on to, you know, direct films and produce films and just, you know, really made his mark across the board. But doing all of that while struggling mightily to, you know, protect his own image, protect his own career, and be, you know, somewhat politically engaged and hopefully, you know, in his own way, doing things that were lifting up African Americans across the country. And, you know, I mean, you get a lot of people at like the AFI Awards and, you know, like Morgan Freeman and all the people that kind of came, Louis Gossett Jr. and all these guys that came behind him. Denzel Washington, who laud him for kind of leading the way through that. But, you know, there should be just as many white people doing the same thing, saying, thank God, you know, you were sure. there and kind of handled yourself in the way you handled yourself and made the career you were able to make, because it did change the opportunities across the board in cinema for not just African-Americans, but, you know, other races that came behind that were even further down that food chain, the Hispanic communities and the Asian American communities.
Yeah, and I think Hollywood was probably ready to pat themselves on the back for representation back in 64, 63, whenever he does 100%, win.
100%, they were already doing it. Yeah.
And so he has to keep on, putting out some of better and better and better, better work for a few years before it really starts shaking things up. And it takes the context of culture, revolution, civil rights.
Yeah, and I mean, even things like the independent film world of like Melvin Van Peebles and Charles Burnett and guys like that who came out and started really doing their own thing. And even blaxploitation to some degree, mm-hmm. when it hit hard in the early 70s, it kind of opened things up. He and Bill Cosby, I get it. But I mean, you got to understand, like, the only other guy on the planet in 1965 who was accepted by American society, and that was a man of color in the entertainment industry, specifically in television and mm-hmm. film, was Bill Cosby.
Yeah.
Because of I Spy. Yeah. Just to put that into perspective, asked at a press conference for Guess Who's Coming to Dinner, may have been for In the Heat of the Night, but one of the two films. Anyway, a Hollywood journalist said, can you name any other black or Negro actors that are working right now? And he had to spell Bill Cosby's last name.
Wow.
Because she didn't know who that was. This is 1967.
Damn.
That's how alone Sidney Poitier was in the world as a black man in America making movies.
Greatest of all time. Well, come see Guess Who's Coming to Dinner this Thursday. Despite it being a soft liberal movie, it is some incredible performances.
Oh, it's insane. I mean, listen, Spencer Tracy was at death's door making that movie.
At death's door?
There you go.
Also, tonight we'll be playing the band called Death. A band called Death. Are we all ready to wrap this up? Enjoy this nice day. Let Jack stay inside and we can go zip outside. Are we feeling that?
Yeah.
All right. Now we want everyone to meditate.
You can order some food, maybe.
We're going to order some food. We're going to meditate.
That's great.
We're going to stop talking about movies.
We should always keep it at this level.
Right? Yeah, maybe we should.
It's like the NPR voice.
Just let the world turn.
Movies. Do they matter? Should they matter? See ya.
Pick up the glass. Don't let your head keep running. Whatever is behind you,
thanks for listening to this program on Full Service Radio, broadcasting and recording from the Line Hotel in Adams Morgan, Washington, D.C. Full Service Radio programming can be accessed live and archived on fullserviceradio.org. Our talk programming is available on most podcast apps like iTunes and Stitcher, and our DJ sets are available on mixcloud.com/fullserviceradio. Full Service Radio features over 30 weekly shows and over 50 local hosts covering every topic imaginable. If you want to be a guest or get involved, email us at info@fullserviceradio.org. Follow us on Twitter @FullServiceRDO, on Instagram and Facebook @FullServiceRadio. Thanks for listening.